And welcome back to Coast. Sir Charles Schulz worked at Martin Marietta Aerospace for 10 years on weapon systems and computer-based automated test equipment. Charles has performed research under a grant on nuclear fusion, was knighted, and received a long-term grant for his present research in robotics and artificial intelligence. And he has written many technical publications and magazine articles on space, astronomy, the atmosphere, and space resource development. And here he is on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Sir Charles. How are you?
I'm doing very well, George. Thank you. And you?
Good. Very good. Lots to talk with you about. I wanted to talk with you about Mars, and the next hour we'll spend some time talking about these new energy sources.
Well, certainly.
In technology. I guess I remember years ago when we first started talking about some of the possible fossils on Mars. Since that time, have you changed your opinions at all, one way or another?
Oh, not at all. In fact, the more we look, the more we discover. What really surprises me is so many people who look at the results, and I've spent time with hundreds of scientists and other people showing them these things, they all agree when they see it. I've had literally nobody say, that's not what you're looking at.
Yeah, well, there's something there. It's very strange, isn't it?
It certainly is. I think that what's happening really is there are a lot of people within the agency, NASA and Jet Propulsion Lab, who want to say what they've got, but they're running afoul of regulation and they're superiors. And
you know,
that seems to be changing. Sorry.
That's right. They keep, you know, telling us, you know, there's water there and there might be organisms there. Why don't they just come out with a big story and just tell us?
You know, that's a very good question. And I got a very good friend who had a meeting with the JPL president, and during that time, they had a run-in with a presidential advisor who became very upset and was literally yelling, you're not going to find life on Mars. And, you know, if you hear something statement like that, you have to wonder what they're thinking. And I've begun to think, just based on what I've read in NASA publications and others, they often state that they need to have some sort of a protocol in place to handle the release of this information to people because they don't want to see widespread panic. And that seems like a very small-minded approach to it to me.
Yeah, I think so, too. Look, to me, there's no question that Mars was once a planet teeming and laden with water, probably vegetation. Something horrible happened to it, and it all died off and went away.
Well, certainly. It looks very much like it was a climatic change. Mars's water is still present. It's in the form of glaciers under no more than, let's say, an inch of soil in many cases. And I have some information that I was given very recently by a fellow who does research in this in Germany. And he made me promise not to publish it right away until he had the permission for it. He managed to get the original Viking lander calibration data. And this is something that is not generally available. And in it, the original calibration was done on Earth with the Viking imagers. And they received all that data for calibrating the color properly, and they noticed that there was a tiny piece of metal plated in gold next to the image sensor, and it reflects only in the red part of the spectrum, not the green or the blue. And so it drove the red calibration up, and the error was overlooked. Now, when you apply the original data to the pictures they sent back from Mars in 1976, you see blue skies, red, white, and blue flag, and the color balance is perfect. So I am working very hard to get that information available to publish, because once people see it, they'll see that all along the skies are indeed blue on Mars, not this yellow or murky brown you see in some of the images, and it's been a very simple error that's been propagated for over 30 years.
Charles, are you seeing any change at all with NASA? I mean, I'm sure whistleblowers are there doing what they do, but are you seeing any external change there?
Absolutely, yes. What surprised me just recently was a recent check to the site, and they had made admissions that the fossil meteorite, which made so much news many years ago, apparently does have validity. They are finally admitting the planet was covered in oceans and that they're tentatively saying there may have been life. Now, the fossil meteorite we're speaking about, which was at the center of a very great controversy for years, is one that was found in Antarctica in the Allen Hills. And this is a piece of Mars that was knocked off the planet by a huge impact. And the piece appears to be about 4 billion years old. And within that piece of rock, there are signs that there was liquid water on the surface of Mars about 4 billion years ago, and it formed tiny granules of a material known as carbonate. And in the carbonate, they found traces of other materials, such as organic molecules and what looked like little worm trails, holes in the rock, and tiny bits of magnetite mineral. Well, the controversy was they said, well, those things could have been formed in other ways. And as the team found ways to beat the objections, there was no news made about that. Well, finally, they're admitting, you know, it looks like Mars had liquid water and perhaps life, perhaps earlier than the Earth did. So this is the thing that's been the central part of the controversy in recent years, since about 1996.
You know, Richard Hoagland has always said that he believes we are the Martians, that somehow, you know, they made their trek here. Not a bad theory, Charles.
Well, it's not a bad theory at all. You know, if organisms arise on any planet in a solar system that's farther out from the sun, and something strikes that planet and carries meteorites to the other planets, they can literally seed those planets with bacteria. And we have very good evidence that this has happened on the Earth. Mars shows pictures of what's known as rock varnish or desert varnish on many of its rocks, and we can see it on the surface of the planet. And desert varnish is on the Earth as well. And when we look at the deserts, particularly in the Southwest in this country, we see this dark, shiny coating on the rocks. And it is a living organism. It's produced by an organism, but it grows very slowly, and it is an extremophile. It'll take severely dry, arid conditions, just like those that you see on Mars. And the interesting thing about desert varnish is that it contains backwards amino acids. And what this means to the technically literate person is everything that lives uses proteins, amino acids, and sugars. And we use, as life on Earth, right-handed sugars and left-handed amino acids. In the samples of desert varnish that you can take right here on the Earth, there are reversed or mirrored molecules, and this is a sign of alien life. These amino acids are backwards.
Yeah, it does. But why do you think they're holding back? Why do you think they're not telling us?
You know, the two things that I hear most often are religious reasons and economic reasons. And neither of them makes any sense to me. The biggest issue is, if everybody knew that there was life in space, there's a feeling by people in government that the religious repercussions would be those that would be the greatest. And to that end, they had a conference in 1999, and they released something called the NASA Societal Report. And in the report, they said they wanted to have a response in place or a protocol in place to handle the reaction of the public. They feel that religious people are going to go nuts because this violates everything they believe. What's very, very interesting to me is religions such as Islam or, you know, any of the religions in China or in India, all of these religions face the possibility of life outside of the Earth very easily. It's basically Bible Belt Christian religion that they're talking about when they say that there would be objections. And you see, I don't understand why would this change everything? Why would it cause an uproar? It wouldn't.
Charles, Stephen Hawking, physicist, said a few weeks ago that he believes there is life out there, extraterrestrial life, but that we should not be trying to contact them, that it could be a disaster. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a little late for that. We've been broadcasting radio waves and television to space for decades, and everything we've been sending since about the 1940s is getting out of the atmosphere and spreading out like the ripples in a pond.
It's out
our
there.
Planet is louder than the radio noise of our sun, which is a star, and all stars produce some radio noise. So if people were to use radio telescopes, they'd see our planet glowing with radio waves. And it's not like we're going to hide them. So if somebody were to say, hey, look, we better not contact aliens, I'm afraid it's a little too late. We've already sent our ripples into the pond, and they're going to be detected by anybody who has the means.
That may be true. Charles, when we come back, I want to talk with you about SETI and get your thoughts on that, and then we'll talk more about Mars and what you think the planet looked like maybe a few billion years ago. Charles Schultz, our special guest tonight on coasttocoastam.com. He's got a couple websites all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And a couple incredible works, A Living Galaxy and A Fossil Hunter's Guide to Mars. We'll be right back. And welcome back. We've got Sir Charles Schultz tonight on Coast to Coast. Sir Charles Schultz, indeed. Charles, tell us on the low end what you think Mars might have looked like a billion years ago.
Well, a billion years ago, the atmosphere would have been considerably thicker there, probably about 50 millibars of pressure overall. And the weather would have been extremely different. There would have been a thicker atmosphere. There would have been more carbon dioxide. Lakes, seas, rivers would have been everywhere. And, of course, anytime you have a biosphere, you've got to have plants to support it. All the energy to keep animals alive is harvested generally from plants. And so it would have been a very familiar place, but you still wouldn't have been able to live there because the air still would have been very, very thin compared to what we're used to. Yet there would have been life and water everywhere on the planet. It would have been a green world, most likely.
Now, on the high end, do you think they had intelligent life like ours?
I don't think that anything more intelligent than animal life ever evolved on the planet Mars. If there was ever any intelligence on the planet, it would have been a visitor from another solar system, not from here. You see, the conditions for the evolution of intelligent life really don't appear to have been present. There are what's known as energy constraints. When the air is that thin and your resources are that sparse, you really don't have enough energy to support the development of truly intelligent life. On the other hand, you know, we really don't know all the answers. It's a possibility, but it's, I would say, an outside one.
What about one of its moons, Phobos?
Ah,
artificial or real?
Well, you know, a billion years ago, those moons weren't there. They appear to be captured asteroids, and those asteroids are so close to the planet that its gravity is literally flexing them and tearing them apart. So when you look at the moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, you see cracks moving through the moons like parallel lines. This is because they're within what's known as the Roche limit. They're very close to it. This is where the tidal force of a planet will literally rip something else to pieces. And we've seen that in other places as well. Saturn's rings appear to be the result of a moon being pulled apart by its gravity.
So, again, you do not believe they were artificial?
No, I don't. I think they were just captured asteroids. Because Mars is rather close to the asteroid belt, very close indeed.
I wonder if they saved us by grabbing, by grabbing those asteroids, then those moons from hitting us.
Well, it's possible. You know, Jupiter does that all the time, and we've seen some monumental impacts in its atmosphere in the last few years. So we do know that a planet can shield the Earth from being hit by asteroids or comets. We've seen that in Jupiter's atmosphere at least twice within the last 10 years.
Our friends at SETI have been trying to find extraterrestrial life. They've been beaming signals. They've been listening for signals. Nothing happening yet. Let's get back into that for just a second. Do you think we're doing the right thing by sending signals, by listening for signals?
Yes, I do. First of all, we've only sent two specific signals to space. So the amount of signals that we have intentionally sent has been very, very small. There's a real nervousness among people that if they send a signal, it might cause a response. And in one case, the signal they sent would take 30,000 years to get to its destination. So, you know, that was just kind of a watch me, I'm going to do it. And then it was just a little tiny effort that wouldn't result in anything happening for thousands of years. But, you know, when we send a signal out into space, we don't really know where it's going to go. And we've been doing it all the time in the form of television, as I mentioned earlier. With SETI, it was a very specific, very narrow frequency set of information they sent. Listening is very good because it's passive. It doesn't leave any marks, and you can listen to anything. We've actually even scanned nearby solar systems for ultraviolet laser light in some cases. But SETI has been sitting there with their dishes analyzing for radio signals, and you know, they've made a really big mistake in what they're looking for. Two of them that I can typify very easily. Number one, they assume that life is going to be around stars that are very much like our sun. And yellow stars like our sun make up less than 8% of the stars in the galaxy right now. So you've got only 1 out of 12 stars to look at off the top. Actually, life could easily form around other suns that live as long as our sun, such as orange stars or red stars. And red stars are about 70%, such as red dwarf suns, are about 70% of the population of stars in our galaxy. So if even 1 out of 7 of those was a home for life, we'd have over double what we expected to look for right away. If we start scanning other stars, such as red and orange suns, then we could certainly find a much better source of signals than we've looked at in times past. But the other issue is very simple. We're looking at what's known as the water hole, a very specific set of frequencies. And it's not just one channel. It's many, many channels. But it's confined to a strict series of frequencies that are given off by the presence of water in space, hydroxyl ions. Now, I'm not going to broadcast on that frequency, and I don't know of anybody else who does, and the governments even call it a restricted space. You can't broadcast on that set of frequencies for very strict reasons, and part of it has to do with radio astronomy. The issue here is, if you were to look for those signals, you got a needle in a haystack chance. But if there was something you could do to increase your chances, if you really wanted to be heard, what you would broadcast or what you would listen for would be the waterhole frequencies multiplied by perhaps a mathematical constant, like the number pi or e, the base of the natural logarithms. So here's why this is important. You need to find a signal that absolutely, positively had to be artificial. And how do you know that? One way is to broadcast prime numbers. Prime numbers are a very simple signature, and anybody could recognize them and go, you know, there's not a natural process that would make those sorts of signals.
Right.
If you broadcast them on more than one channel at once, and let's say the first channel is pi times the waterhole, and the second channel is e times the waterhole, and the third one might be pi times e times the waterhole, now you've got three very distinct frequencies that cannot be generated by accident, and all three of them be carrying a signal at once. And you know without a shadow of a doubt that somebody would actually be trying to talk to you. We should be looking for signals of that nature, very broadband signals, not the narrowband stuff, and at mathematical constants, not the waterhole frequencies.
Is it possible that if there's extraterrestrial life out there that is thousands and thousands of years ahead of us, that they may not even know anymore how to send us a signal that we could pick up?
Well, if a civilization were to fall, that's certainly possible. They would lose their technology. But, you know, I always consider the universe to be a message, and we are its interpreters. And any intelligent race who begins to learn about the world around them will discover the same basic principles that we will. And radio communication is such a simple, blindingly obvious thing when you reach a certain level of sophistication. It's very simple. And so if a race was advanced by thousands of years beyond us, we would feel that perhaps their interests would lie elsewhere. I know that if you look at how things have changed to a virtual world rather than a real world just here on Earth in the last few years, you see people get more and more wrapped up in simulations, video games, mathematics, things that derive from the mind and not from the world around us. And I might expect that other civilizations could take the same path. They may be so wrapped up in their virtual worlds or their other concerns or tasks we can't even imagine that it would be beyond them, you know, as to why they'd even want to talk to us, unless they're worried about our emergence as a technical civilization. And that's, you know, that's one possibility. You know, when you think about the universe and life in the universe, when the universe is an empty place and we're the only life in it, it seems kind of safe. But when you suddenly discover that we've got neighbors anywhere, now you wonder, well, yeah, there's life, but are they friendly or are they dangerous or what? And so it raises a whole new set of questions.
Well, it sure does. And do you think that advancement, given the fact that they're more advanced than us years-wise, that given advancement that they would chronologically move at that same pace that we've moved at, and that would be, you know, how we're evolving technologically, that they probably went through a very similar step to get
there? Yes. I would think so, because it takes the same steps to reach a certain path generally. We had to learn physics. We had to learn electricity. We had to learn optics. We had to learn how to work the material world around us in the forms of metals and ceramics and plastics. And you will expect that any technical civilization will have gone through the same or very similar phases. They had farming, they had schools, they had the same things we did. And at some point, we reach a level, and it seems that we're almost there now, where the flow of information overtakes us, and it's called the singularity. We can't predict what's going to happen next. And a really advanced civilization will have reached this point and passed it. If they survive, then we don't even know what they would be like. But I imagine that because of the way we're learning how to do things with nanotechnology and forces and energy today, you would expect a truly advanced civilization to do things so amazing that we couldn't even describe them. It would just seem like magic. And this sort of a civilization may have inscrutable aims. We don't know what they would be interested in.
What about other planets in our solar system? Let's say Venus. Do you think it might have similar fossils that you say are on Mars?
You know, that's a very good question. And what I found is the general consensus is Venus probably was capable of supporting life 3 billion years ago. And the differences are that Venus is so close to the sun's temperature has been increasing gradually over time, and it literally baked the planet to death. So any fossils that would have formed at that distant past would have been very difficult to spot as traces in a rock. And now you've got to deal with an incredible pressure and temperature and a corrosive atmosphere. So if there were any traces of fossils on Venus, by now they've been baked out of existence or corroded away in all likelihood. And, you know, just as a side note, the temperature on Venus is well over 900 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface, and the pressure is about 70, 80 atmospheres of pressure. The air is so thick on Venus that a gentle breeze would carry you along like being in a stream of water. So it's an incredible, hot, crushing, smothering place where it rains sulfuric acid mist. And I don't think that we'd really be well served to try and look for fossils on the planet.
No. 900 degrees, that's about as hot as St. Louis gets in the summer. I'm telling you. Hey, give me a take. What do you think of this this oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico?
That's amazing to me. I think that it looks like a series of blunders, one thing after the other.
Yeah.
If you look at this from the engineering standpoint, why in the world would you design a platform that can sink? We've known how to make sink-proof caisson platforms for an awful long time. They have them in the North Sea all the time, and you don't hear about the thing sinking there. Here's another thing. Wouldn't you mandate that the pipe leading from the ocean floor up to your platform would have flotation devices on it to keep it upright and rigid?
Always.
And
exactly.
Here's another one. Wouldn't you have a cutoff valve so that, like a dead man switch, so that if something happened, that valve would automatically shut? It just amazes me from one end to the other that some thinking was not put into the implementation. And I'm sure a lot of people said, you know, we need to have this, and it probably was a budget issue or something, got cut for some reason or another.
They went the cheap route, I think.
Oh, of course. You know, that's what does us in every time. We have the capability to do absolutely anything we can imagine, and we always go the cheap route. And it would be a wonderful study of human psychology to find out why that is. But right now, the big cost is into life. And you know what amazes me? We're told it takes all this energy to pump this oil out of the ground. This thing is gushing.
It's gushing. I think
that's very unusual that this sort of oil would be gushing out of the hole. I guess they're talking about using the pumps to haul it to the surface, maybe, but it seems to be doing a very good job of it all by itself, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, they say that it's slowing down a little bit because of the natural gas down there.
Yeah.
But still, it amazes me that they have tapped into a vein in Mother Earth, and she is just really unhappy right now.
Well, you know what's most interesting is there was a fellow by the name of Thomas Gold, and he worked with Russian petrologists years ago, and he came to the conclusion that oil was not fossils, that there wouldn't be a limit to it, that it's all through the mantle of the Earth, and it was formed.
I agree with him, the abiotic oil theory.
Absolutely, because when a planet forms, there are gases trapped in the dust and gas in space, and methane is primary in that. And when that material ends up trapped under pressure and heat inside a planet, it cooks it and it makes petroleum. And some of the hydrogen is released and it makes water vapor because it reacts with the minerals. And you end up with salt domes, metal, water vapor, and oil all in one place. And that's exactly what we see. And those reaction sites would have been, you know, a couple of hundred kilometers down, you know, like 300 miles down or more. And we find oil deeper and deeper as we drill. Well, there's no way in the world that living organisms, fossils, ended up that far underground. The Earth hasn't been turned over that much.
This episode has really quieted those people who believe in the plankton, plants, and dead dinosaur theory of oil.
Oh, absolutely. When you start looking at the practical issues here, there's no way in the world, and I keep saying that because it's outstanding to me how clear it is. There were never enough dinosaurs laying around dead on the ground to make all this oil. It's just ludicrous to think that there were.
No, or plant life or anything. And then when you talk about it getting 5,000 feet down and then underneath the surface of the ocean down there.
Yes. Well, actually, that's not much of an issue because the Gulf has raised and lowered over time. As you know, geology lifts and drops portions of the land. Still, even though it's under a mile of water, it had to get into that rock somehow. And, you know, if you put a cork in the water, it rises. It floats to the top. Oil has a very low density, and so do salt domes. Rock has a density of about 3.5, 3.5 times the density of water generally. Oil is about 70% the density of water. How would something lighter sink?
Exactly. How would it sink?
It doesn't.
Charles, next hour I want to talk about alternative energy, and then we'll take phone calls with you in our third hour as well. It's the space initiative, the fact that we are apparently just going to go to an asteroid. We're not going to go to the moon, and we may go to Mars in 20 or 30 years. Who knows? What do you think?
Well, you know, there was a recently mention of the fact that some people felt that we would be going to orbit Mars by 2035, and there was a mention by the Obama administration this would happen. They've turned their sights away from a mission to the moon, and instead they focused on asteroids and Mars. It could happen. What really piques my interest about this is that they make such a statement when we've seen similar initiatives started over the last 20 years, and we've just basically cut the whole moon program apart. NASA did receive an extra $6 billion just in the new budget to pursue other issues such as a sample return mission. So they're really hot on getting somebody to Mars. This is really interesting because if they believe that the planet was dead and lifeless, never had any water, why would they have so much interest suddenly in getting a man there? And realize that if you travel to Mars, it's a seven-month flight at least with the given technology, 7 to 10 months. And it means that by the time you get there, your exposure to radiation away from the Earth and in deep space would probably make you a lifelong resident there. It's probably going to be fatal. We need a way of getting there in a few days or no more than a couple of weeks.
How did you get interested in the fossil Mars story?
Well, I was doing some research for a rover model that could be operated by students over the Internet. It was going to be a knockoff little robotic rover. And I was analyzing the pictures and found these fossil traces in them. But the real history goes back to about 1992 when I wrote an article about what to look for on Mars if you were to look for organisms. And everything that I had written had been about the magnetite crystals, the aromatic hydrocarbons, the other materials based on the gold hypothesis. And so I wrote this article, and then 4 years later, the Martian meteorite controversy came to bear, and it had everything that I'd predicted in the original article, and I thought, well, this is it. They found it. But, you know, Mars is so much like the Earth, and it has an interesting history. It was made from the same materials at the same time, and we have many planets in our solar system that could show signs of life. Mars was just the most obvious one. But, you know, if you really look at it, we have moons of Jupiter like Europa and Ganymede, and they have oceans underneath their crust of ice, and even that far from the sun, the flexing heat from Jupiter's gravity warms them the interiors of these moons. Recent studies show that both of them have colors, spectral maps, that exactly match the spectra of bacteria here on the Earth. Now, that's a very interesting finding.
It sure is.
And look at Enceladus, the icy moon of Saturn.
Oh, it's spewing
liquid water where there shouldn't be any, and it's full of organic molecules. And, you know, if you look at the color pictures they've released, the cracks in the ice seem to have green stuff in it. It's fascinating, isn't it? There could be five living worlds in this solar system.
I think this universe, Charles, is teeming with life. How intelligent it gets, who knows? But I think life itself, the soup that makes it, it's all the same.
Absolutely, and it's present everywhere. The material, the soup of life is called tholin, and we can see it everywhere in space that we look. It's covering even planets out in the area of Neptune and Pluto and out in the Oort cloud, the bodies in the icy darkness that can extend maybe 2 or 3 light years from the sun.
Charles, when we come back next hour, we'll talk about some promising new developments in energy. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Will we ever get new developments in energy use, Charles, where we can save some money, not rely on oil, regardless of where it comes from?
Absolutely. We have moved so close to that point that it's amazing, and there are many new developments that I'll talk about, some of which are things that we can do in our own backyard, but some are really big and on the horizon. So, yes, let's get into that subject right away.
All right, let's do that. And, of course, you know, here we are. What are the possibilities today? What do we have on the horizon now? We've got solar, wind. What else is out there?
Well, there actually are real progress steps being taken in the generation of fusion power, and that looks like they're getting ready to do some testing very shortly. They've built some large test reactors, and they're going to be trying to fuse hydrogen. And there's also the possibility of fusing a form of helium known as helium-3. Other countries are actually starting to mine the moon for that very shortly. It's in their plans. And that fuel will be the most common fuel for nuclear fusion reactors soon. Another thing that people are looking at is what's known as random thermal energy. There are ways of taking the random motion of molecules or patterns of particles moving around and extracting a little bit of energy from them. This is not the same as zero-point energy. You know, it's not the same thing at all. But imagine a ratchet. If you strike a ratchet, it only moves in one direction forward, and it won't move in the other direction. Well, using nanotechnology, we can create tiny ratchets that respond to being struck by particles that are moving under random heat and can extract a little bit of energy from them. And if you create sheets of this material in a form like a battery, then you actually can have a cell that charges itself based on random heat. So that's one of the things that's being explored. We've got a lot of really interesting things like this coming up.
Do you ever see the day, Charles, where a home, an individual's home, will be self-contained?
Well, absolutely. We had them a century ago. Why can't we have them now with all the technology we have? You know, you look at how farmers and people in rural settings lived at the beginning of the 1900s, they were all self-sufficient. It was only when we got onto the electricity jag, we have all of our toys that run on electricity, all of our devices, that we ended up hooking to the grid to power everything. Well, there are many mandates that have been put in place so that homes, new construction, particularly in California, have to produce more energy than they consume. So, you know, legislating it doesn't make it happen, but it surely provides the impetus to get it to happen. So we're going to see many, many advancements. The big thing that stood in the way is not how to generate that power, but how to store that power. And new storage technologies are also emerging that will allow us to run a small windmill, some solar panels or something similar, and save that energy up so it can run all night. That's our biggest problem right now.
What about batteries? Are batteries, and I mean batteries that are used in flashlights, radios, just about anything we use.
Oh, there are billions of batteries created every year and then thrown away when they're expended. Batteries are terribly expensive. In fact, throwaway power cells are one of the most expensive forms of energy there is, and that's why so many battery companies exist. There will be a move to get rid of the batteries soon. The first steps have been taken with fuel cells. They have a fuel cell that consumes a simple mixture of methyl alcohol and water, and it acts just like a hydrogen fuel cell, but you put a little ampoule in it. You've seen the little perfume ampoules you can get at sample containers. You have a little ampoule like that full of methanol, and it goes into the unit, and it runs by consuming that fuel, producing nothing but carbon dioxide and a little water vapor, and it makes the battery for cell phones and laptops and that sort of thing. Now, right now they're terribly expensive because most fuel cells, particularly specialty cells, have a lot of expensive metals like platinum and rhodium and palladium inside the electrodes. But they're coming down.
And how long would that power last?
Generally, a little ampoule of liquid about the size of your little finger can run a laptop for up to a week or more.
Is it rechargeable?
Absolutely. You just drop the ampoule out, put more alcohol in it, you put it in, and you run it some more. So it's almost like a little engine, but it doesn't make any noise and does no movement. Then it uses electronics and chemistry to combust the fuel and make electricity directly, just like the space shuttle's fuel cells do.
If you used it in a radio, but let's say you only ran your radio for an hour or 2 hours, shut it off again. Some batteries, for example, will last. I know Bob Crane at the C. Crane, one of our sponsors, they have batteries that last in their radios, some up to 70 hours. How long, what if you were able eventually to put these little capsules in a radio, how long would they run a radio that went on and off sometimes?
Well, if the radio was being turned on and off, you probably could run the thing for a year or more.
Oh, my gosh.
You see, the consumption of power in a radio is typically much, much less than it is for, let's say, a laptop. And if you can get a week of use out of a laptop, you could get many, many weeks out of a radio that you were only running intermittently. So this is a very safe, very compact method of storing power, and it's very, very efficient.
Russians are talking about building a nuclear plant in Syria. We know what's happening in Iran. Is there a better way to generate power today, Sir Charles, than nuclear power plants?
Well, there are different methods, you know, that can give us pretty good density. Nuclear power plants have a pretty high density. That's one of the issues. And they're so easy to fuel. I mean, face it, you know, you can have one vehicle drive enough fuel to a nuclear plant to run it for a year. And the waste produced by them really isn't that great. If you had a 1 billion-watt nuclear plant, the waste from running it for a year would fit in 1 cubic meter. You could put it under a dining room table.
Yeah.
And a lot of people object to the use of nuclear. But, you know, that really only happens over there. In the United States, the use of nuclear power has languished, and now I'm in an area where they're building 2 nuclear reactors right here in South Carolina. You know, for every watt of power that's produced, there is a tariff on it. And there's been a nuclear waste fund that has accumulated over the years of about $33 billion. And this was meant to help dispose of nuclear waste. The interesting thing is, in this country, what they did was they made it illegal to recycle nuclear waste. Now, in other countries, such as France, France is well over 90% nuclear, and they recycle all their waste. And, you know, in fact, if you look at the picture, France, Great Britain, Russia, Germany, Belgium, and Japan, just to name a few, all recycle their nuclear waste. And
now, when you say recycle, what do you mean recycle it? What do they do with it?
You literally reprocess it into fuel rods, pull out the dangerous materials, and set them aside to break down. So this is a known technology, and it's been around for decades. It's simply a matter of the law in this country that it's not done. And we wouldn't need to use places like the Yucca Mountain storage. About $10 billion in a number of years has gone into the Yucca Mountain facility.
Yeah.
And suddenly some people have said, well, maybe this isn't the right way to do it. And now they're taking another look at it. So, and I saw one of these TED Talks, you've probably heard of the things, where they have a keynote speaker who's knowledgeable about a certain subject.
Yeah, and they go around the country.
Right. And in one of them, Bill Gates had mentioned that he was going to put some money up to help solve the nuclear waste issue. Well, that amazed me, because this is a man who is in touch, you would think, and would know these issues, and yet we already have solutions to the nuclear waste issues. We had a device known as the Phoenix Reactor that was developed many years ago, and it's interesting. You go online, you don't find anything about it. It's just vanished. But the Phoenix Reactor was unique in that it was meant to burn nuclear waste directly. And, in fact, we do have reactors that will burn nuclear waste. They'll break it down. Now, overseas, they use breeder reactors in many cases, and they literally make more fuel than they use. And then, of course, recycling is a very important part of the equation. It really comes down to what sort of power do we need, how much do we need, and what are we willing to do to get it. Nuclear can be done safely and cleanly. It can be managed properly. It's just got a really black eye over the last couple of decades because we've had a couple of disasters where human beings didn't do what the telltales, the machines, and the alarms said, and then we ended up with problems like Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. Now, it's important to point out, Chernobyl is an incident that could never happen in this country because the design they used was very, very different. It's a very primitive design. We don't build reactors like that, and we can't have that sort of a disaster. It can't happen, because the geometry and the construction is completely different. But in instances such as Three Mile Island, basically somebody heard an alarm and went, oh, that thing, and turned it off, and it snowballed from there. But we really, you know, it's one of the cleanest and safest methods of generating power. If you burn coal, for every watt of power you produce with coal, roughly 10 times more radioactive material ends up in the environment than from the nuclear plant generating power. And it's the material that's in the coal itself that ends up getting into the atmosphere that's burnt. With the releases of radioactive material that you hear about from a nuclear plant, it's generally something like radon gas that breaks down in a few days and there's nothing left of it.
Politics aside, like Iran, are they going the right way when they need power so they build nukes?
Well,
and plants?
You know, I would say yes. The only issue that stands in people's minds is the availability and the production of weapons-grade material.
Right.
You see, you would consider that a country that is rich in petroleum would not be short of energy. Well, the issue is that basically many of the Middle Eastern countries tend to sell their oil, and they're very, very conservative about it at home.
Right.
And that surprises people. I mean, they literally, in some cases, I've seen where they will drive with their headlights off to save gas and just flash them at you on the road so you know they're there. That seems silly, but it's the mindset. We're saving energy.
Yeah, I would guess the energy costs there are higher, and also they don't have as much. They probably have shortages.
Well, it's not so much that the cost itself is higher, but the general income of the individual, the per capita income, is much lower in many of these countries. And so it takes more hours of their hard work to generate the money to pay for fuel. So, and that's a very real concern. We are used to having enough income from our hours' labor to pay for all the toys and things that we like. And that isn't necessarily true in other countries, particularly in countries in the Middle East.
I guess we can't monitor their plants, can we? So we let them build their new plants, but we monitor them?
Well, a lot of monitoring can be done remotely, and it wouldn't surprise me in the least if we didn't have somebody on the inside as well that there's nothing said about. But we have the capability of detecting a lot of the signatures of a nuclear plant in operation. Realize that there is radiation given off that can be detected remotely. There are things that happen in terms of release of heat that can be monitored by an infrared satellite. You can look at things like the power of the magnetic field from a generator, and you can estimate how much power is coming out of it. So there are a lot of things we can see about a power plant. We can't necessarily see what's happening inside the power plant without actually having somebody present, which is the whole purpose behind, for instance, UN safety inspections. So that could be a real problem.
Yeah, that could be. Let's talk about our cars for just a moment.
Sure.
When will we be able to have either hydrogen cars or something, or maybe drop a little capsule in gallons of water and we have fuel? Is that ever going to happen?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as the capsule thing, but, you know, we do have the possibility of making hydrogen vehicles right now. Now, there are two ways we can go with hydrogen. Number one, if you save it in a container, a cylinder of some sort, and you use it as fuel, just as you would burn gasoline, you have an engine that would produce generally just water vapor. The issue there is you don't want the combustion in the chambers to be too hot or you produce nitrogen oxides. So that can be done, but the limits are how much hydrogen you can actually store. Hydrogen is the lightest element in the universe, and it's very difficult to store enough of it to be able to drive a car around the way we do with a tank of gas.
Right.
The other face of this is electrical power. You see, when you're running internal combustion, the best automobile engine gets about 38% of the energy of the fuel out as movement, getting you there. The rest
not that efficient, is it?
Yeah, most of them aren't. That's like the peak. So most of them run around 25, 30% at best. And so that means the other 75% of that energy goes away as heat and noise. Well, we don't want that. Obviously, we can do better. When you get down to electrical propulsion, that is a different ball game. If you have a fuel cell in your vehicle and you store enough hydrogen to operate the fuel cell, now you make basically an electric car that runs strictly on electricity that's produced by the fuel cell. So the hydrogen becomes a fuel that runs the battery, not the engine itself, and then you run off of electrical current. Now, what really killed the electric car many years ago was in part the mass of the batteries and the energy they stored. And, you know, most of them had figures like you can drive 30, 40 miles.
Yeah, and then you got to plug it in again or something.
Well, and that is the sticking point. You realize that if you plug in and charge an electric vehicle, the energy it takes to go a mile can be three or four times greater than if you were to just get it out of gasoline.
Absolutely. Plus, I mean, we're going to have blackouts. How can you use that much electricity?
You can't. We simply don't have the infrastructure in place. If we went to electric vehicles that had to be plugged in to charge, we'd absolutely bring the grid down.
Absolutely.
Now, some of the proponents of the electrical vehicle movement state that, well, we can even burn coal for power plants, and you can run an electric car off of coal instead of petroleum. Come on, guys. You know, that's not such a big change. You're still putting a lot of CO2 and other materials in the atmosphere, and you still depend on the grid being up to charge your car. And those are real Achilles heels. We don't want a car that has to sit in the garage for hours and hours to charge up. So there are some technologies that are changing. Number one, hydrogen storage, and this is very exciting. They have a very porous plastic that's made of the same stuff that your soda bottles are made out of, polyethylene terephthalate. And it's got holes so small that hydrogen molecules can get inside the holes. This very porous plastic acts like a sponge and absorbs hydrogen. Well, what this means is that you can store a huge amount of hydrogen in a very lightweight, safe-to-handle form. So you essentially end up with a plastic, think of it laminated back and forth like a stack of playing cards or like an air filter in your car. This stuff can store enough hydrogen that you can drive around just like you have a tank of gas. And that's one of the issues they're researching right now, safe storage and how to release the hydrogen out of the material again. I mean, if we could store hydrogen, then it would make sense to put wind and wave generators out on the ocean and make the hydrogen from seawater, and then it becomes a primary source of power and not just a battery. So that's one of the issues that's really important, the storage of hydrogen.
Tell me about your thoughts about zero-point energy. What is that for some people who do not know?
You know, you hear a lot of noise about zero-point energy. Now, in essence, what that is it's the energy that's built into the vacuum itself. If you were to take a volume of space and remove all the matter, all the air, all the light, all the heat, and have nothing but a box of nothingness, and then you began to look at it with a very, very powerful microscope, and you magnified and magnified it, you'd find that at the scale of about, imagine a 1 with a decimal point and 33 zeros behind it, that and a 1 at the very end, that's the scale. If you looked at space at that tiny, tiny scale, like a trillionth of a millionth of a meter, you'd find that it was loaded with energy, so much energy you wouldn't believe it. And so many people have felt that they could tap into this as zero-point energy. Well, this is the energy that powers the random movements of quantum mechanics, the fluctuations of particles on the tiniest of tiniest scales. And if you try to extract this energy, you find that at the short term, a tiny amount can be borrowed, but it has to be paid back. So zero-point energy doesn't look like something that you can really use. I mean, imagine if the entire world were at a million degrees, and you'd think that's a lot of energy, but there's no difference from one point to the next. So even though there's a lot of energy there, you can't extract it. You have to have an uphill and a downhill, a difference, in order to get that energy out. The zero-point energy is in a situation where it's built into the structure of space-time, and it looks like something that would be exceptionally hard to get out. And then you have to ask yourself, well, if you did, what would happen?
Did Tesla come close to understanding this and doing this?
Well, what Tesla did was found interesting ways of transforming energy from one form to another. I don't see any evidence that he did anything with zero-point energy, but what he did was very, very clever indeed. He discovered that resonance, the ability of two things to oscillate at precisely the same frequency, was very important for transforming and sending and receiving power. One of the demonstrations he gave was the ability to light a bank of light bulbs over 20 miles away without wires, broadcasting power to receiver. Well, that sort of technology is now being looked into, and they're discovering that, yes, it can be done. Just a few months ago, I built a system very similar that could broadcast power about 20 feet away.
Let's hold on for just a second, Charles. We'll get right back into that when we come back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, Sir Charles Schulz as well. Phone calls next hour. Sir Charles, you were talking about a broadcast tower.
And, yes.
Let you get back to that.
Well, basically, it's possible to transmit power from a system to a receiver without the use of wires. And there's some research being done on that right now. And I think that this is probably one of the most important things that we could do. Imagine being able to eliminate all of those huge power wires all over the countryside and not having to maintain those towers, the copper wires, and worrying about an ice storm bringing down the power in an area. So this is a very real possibility. These systems can be built, and research is being done in them now, and I've had some success with them myself, working on simple prototypes. But you see, what's amazing is this is something that was done a century ago by Nikola Tesla, and only now are people coming around and saying, you know, there's something to it. So imagine being able to power things without wiring. This is a very, very important development, and it's something that would make the distribution of power and its reliability far, far better.
I see nothing wrong with paying a nominal cost for energy, do you?
No, not in the least. After all, people have to make a living, and it takes some sort of effort to generate and store and transmit the energy. So certainly, it's just that the cost has gone out of control. I mean, you remember a couple of years ago when diesel fuel was $4 a gallon and up.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
okay.
I think
we get calls
opinion,
from our great our great truck drivers, Charles.
Absolutely.
Call us, and gosh, was it tough on them.
Well, and, you know, I see very clearly, and so do a number of my associates, that this is one of the things that set our economy on the path it's on. When the cost went so high, businesses went out of business. I mean, trucking firms went out of business. Cost of bread went up to a couple of dollars a loaf. And the next thing you know, People can't make their house payments. Well, then we had the bubble in the housing situation. Well, it was mostly because nobody could pay their bills anymore. And it just cascaded like the dominoes. And once things began to happen, you notice the cost of gas dropped right back down very, very rapidly. Just about a year and a half ago, it was down to $1.59 a gallon all of a sudden.
Yeah, that is absolutely true.
Too little, too late.
What are other countries doing compared to what we're doing, which isn't much?
Well, in other countries, they don't have the same subsidies for the cost of energy that we do. Now, other countries are far more into alternatives and biofuel. You know, Germany has a wonderful solar energy movement, and they're basically about the same latitude as Alaska. How do they do it? And Australia is doing huge research into solar energy, basically solar thermal, mirror arrays, capturing the heat, running generators from it. In other countries, biofuel production and use is far greater than it is here. It's very normal in other countries for the use of biofuels such as biodiesel. In fact, about a year ago when we had an extremely cold winter in England, many of the buses wouldn't run because the biodiesel hardened up like lard right inside the pipes in the vehicles, and they couldn't run the buses. But biofuels are really a large part of it, because the source of energy in a biofuel is carbon right out of the atmosphere. We're growing the stuff, and so it means that we're not adding any carbon to the atmosphere. We're simply recycling what's there. You grow plant matter, you ferment it into your fuel or process it into diesel, and you burn it, and it ends up right back where it started. So biofuels are a really nice situation. The only issue is the cost it takes to farm, process, haul the material. And in many cases, it really isn't economically feasible unless you're growing an extremely high-energy fuel, that, and particularly one that has nothing to do with the food market. You may remember the United Nations called for a 5-year moratorium on biofuels after we had that corn to ethanol problem here in this country about a year and a half ago. And when the use of corn for generating ethanol, biofuel, drove the price of corn for food up to the point that nobody could afford to eat, for instance, Mexico, the cost of corn was outrageous, and many people went hungry. But what they didn't know was the corn that was used to produce the ethanol was cattle feed grade, not human food grade.
Now, you know, with algae, what about that?
Algae is a wonderful source of fuel. It is one of the most efficient growing machines on Earth. It can trap sunlight and turn it into biomass at an incredible rate. The issues you run into with algae are, number one, you need to feed it CO2, and so you probably would want to be located near one of those CO2 wells that brings water up that's loaded with this stuff, or you'd want to be near a coal-fired plant to consume their exhaust. The other issue is growing algae requires very specific temperatures and conditions and food in the water for the algae, like phosphates. In a successful algae-growing operation, you also run into having the right breed. You know that people who ferment wine or beer have specific types of yeast that they have developed
Yes.
for their specific product, and it's a closely, jealously guarded secret. You can imagine that in the algae biofuel business, the same situation will spring up where people will test and grow and breed the right algae for their product that works well in their situation. That's one of the things that's coming soon. The people who will make a lot of the money at the outset will be those who stock and breed different types of algae. Now, the issue with algae fuel or algae-derived fuel is, how do you filter microscopic particles out efficiently without using up a lot of filter material? And so one of the things that's slowing down the development of algae fuels is how to get the algae out of the solution effectively so that it's a material that you can process to the next stage. And it's very difficult to do. Filtration generally doesn't work as well as, for instance, a centrifuge. And centrifuges are energy hogs, and they're big. So there are developments coming along, such as using ultrasound to stick the particles of algae together and have them drop out of the solution. They're working on that. That's a big issue.
Can they generate enough fuel to do that?
Well, yes, they could. Algae farming could become one of the things that actually changes our landscape. One of the issues with algae farming is you've got to have water, and lots of it. So this is the sort of thing that's going to happen in an area where you've got plenty of water to work with. Algae can easily generate enough energy because, again, it's a very efficient process means of converting sunlight, raw energy, into a biofuel. But the amount of land that it will take will literally change our landscape if we go to an algae-based fuel production system. Imagine how the breadbasket looks in the U.S. and all the farming done in areas like Central and South Florida and across Kansas where the wheat fields are. Imagine now an area the size of a state where we're growing nothing but algae, but it would be scattered all over our country. That's basically what will happen. Algae farming, if it takes off, will become one of those huge land consumers and water consumers.
What about hemp, Charles?
You know, a lot of people react very negatively when they hear the word hemp. But the fact is, the hemp that they talk about is an industrial grade, and it contains little or no material known as THC in it. So it couldn't be used as a drug, and there's a very positive side to that. Many years ago, during the end of World War II, hemp was one of our major fiber producers in this country. Cotton was completely taken over by the war effort, and we needed all of the material that cotton could produce for fabrics, for everything. And hemp became the leading producer of fabric in this country. Well, at the end of the war, basically there was a huge cotton lobby that made hemp illegal, and it's very, well, you can't even grow hemp in this country anymore. Now, hemp is a wonderful source of material for such products as papers and fabrics and even foods. The seed is used as a cereal, and so the plant itself is actually very effective at growing a huge amount of material. It can be used to produce fabrics and foods and oil, you know, for cooking, for instance. But because it's illegal in this country, it isn't done. I was in Cameroon a little over a year and a half ago, working with the government there on a project to get hemp legalized as an industrial product, not as a drug. And we made a great deal of progress. At this point, it looks like they're poised to make it legal to grow, and then they would have a huge source of economic income. And again, make no mistake, this is not the drug. It's the product used to produce rope and fabric and paper.
I was in a hemp mobile in St. Louis years ago. We did a story on it. Fella came up. He had the whole thing fueled with hemp. And I'm telling you, it worked. The trouble is it cost a lot of money to make a gallon.
Oh, yes. It's incredibly expensive at this point. It isn't until there's an infrastructure in place, like 5,000 people, you know, farming it, that it becomes economically feasible. But we could see that in the very near future. It looks like things are starting to turn around.
Well, that's good news. How about you? New and exciting projects on your plate, Charles?
Well, I've got a new laboratory set up in South Carolina here. I've taken over part of a building that was used for manufacturing automobile parts, and so that's looking very good. And we're giving solar demonstrations for some of the technologies we've developed. And that brings me to another thing. One of the projects I'm working on is to give away some of the technologies I've developed, and I need to be contacted by people who are seriously interested in producing this stuff. I'm going to have some more material on my website about that very shortly, but we ran afoul of trying to get some things done through traditional channels, and there's a lot of opposition to new technologies and new sources of energy. New energy companies are, you know, one of the most highly sued companies that there are in this country.
Really? Why?
And, well, you know, a lot of people work in collaboration with groups, and the groups turn around when they break free and think that they're stepping on their toes or using something they developed together and they have a right to it, and it turns into a lawsuit in many cases. You have to be very careful. So it turns out that energy is one of those big money makers, and anybody who feels that there's a dollar to be made, they want to have their foot in the water. So it turns into high tech and energy, and those two companies, high tech startups and energy startups, are the ones that get sued the most. So there's a lot of slowdown in the development of alternative energy because of that. The other issue is we have all the alternative energy we could ever need and ever want, but the cost of it is out of reach of the common person. I guess the assumption was by many companies that there would be government grants and subsidies to back up the costs. Well, the only issue is it's driven the cost of it out of range for many people because if you don't install it on, let's say, your house, for instance, you don't get the tax breaks in many cases. So we have a lot of things going on in developing new technologies. The other thing we're doing, and I think this is very exciting, we're trying to get ozonators, and I've developed a very efficient generator of ozone for sterilizing drinking water. We're trying to get ozonators in third world countries where there is a real shortage of drinking water. So we're starting an effort right now to try and find the means of placing 1 million ozonators in third world countries.
They have a lot of problems with bacteria and water there, don't they?
Well, absolutely. You know, contaminated water is one of the greatest problems in other parts of the world. And to bring it home, people in this country alone, you will no longer drink tap water. And it's amazing because a lot of the water straight out of the tap tastes like dirt anymore. What happened to our water infrastructure?
Well, you know, we've got pharmaceuticals now in tap water, Charles. I mean, it's everything's all over the place.
Well, you know, they did a survey just about a year and a half ago and discovered that literally every drug is in our water right now because once they're released into the environment, they're not metabolized, and these materials end up right back in the water supply. Who knows what effect it's having on us?
They're not filtered out, are they?
No, they're not. There's not an effective means of doing it, no. Well, we're talking about molecules that are, you know, smaller than any filter would allow. You know, these molecules can get right through a filter very easily. And that was one of the reasons I turned to ozone, because it's a very reactive chemical, and it can destroy just about any organic matter. And once it's done, within a matter of minutes, the stuff is dissipated, and the water is pure and clean. So it's a very obvious solution.
You did some work on EMPs some time ago.
Yes.
I'm concerned that we're going to get hit, not by a nuke, not by an EMP pulse, but by an EMP from the sun, a solar flare, an X flare, that'll shut down the grid.
You know, a few years ago, I was speaking with Dr. Janet Asimov, and she's the widow of Isaac Asimov, the scientist and science writer. And she and I discussed this at great length because we were undergoing a solar max at the time, which is the maximum sunspot activity. And she had a lot of concerns about it. And we certainly do lose sections of grid from time to time when the sun has a little temper tantrum. And what happens is on the sun, explosions propel charged particles such as protons into space. And when they strike the Earth's magnetic field, they can release bursts of energy that show up in our wires. A long stretch of wire acts just like an antenna. And that antenna can pick up this burst of energy, and it can bring the grid down. So the concerns are that when there's a solar flare of great intensity, it can actually bring down the grid in many places. And this is one of the things that's driving the development of the smart grid in this country. We do lose satellites from time to time. And, yes, it's possible. If we had a big, massive solar flare, we could lose our electrical grid pretty quickly. So come to think of it, that's a very good reason to be off the grid and have your own alternative energy right there.
Absolutely. And there's nothing this government is doing to insulate the grid.
Well, that's maybe not. The smart grid is, you know, one of their responses to it. But truly, if you want a system to be stable and unkillable, you distribute it. You get it. You break it up. You don't have one gigantic system. You know, one of the reasons for the grid being the way it is in part that 60-cycle reference frequency that travels in all of our power wires is used as a time base. It's very, very stable. People's clocks run off of it. Their televisions are synchronized to it. Everything runs off that one universal synchronizing signal. So that's one of the reasons the grid is still prevalent today. But once, you know, the storage batteries that they're working on become available, people are going to start cutting off from the grid and storing their own power. Did you know that Coors, the ceramics company, is actually making a battery based on sodium? And they've proven that it works, and they're ready to manufacture if somebody wants to order them. These batteries can actually store enough power to run your home for a couple of days, and they found that they could be charged and discharged every day for 10 years before they go bad.
Interesting.
An amazing battery.
Use it as a generator?
You would use it to store alternative energy that you've gotten from wind or sun, and then be able to run when the wind and sun wasn't there.
So like a capacitor almost.
It'd be like a gigantic capacitor, yes.
How much does that thing cost?
Well, they feel that it would be within the range of any homeowner, so I don't know what their exact numbers are. But for a 10-year battery, it might be worth $5,000, you know?
Well, I guess you get your money back on that. Are there any tax breaks for stuff like this?
There would be, and, you know, that's the thing. If you have an alternative energy system, there still are tax breaks. And consider, if you've got that battery, you're already making your own electricity. You don't have a $500 or $600 a month utility bill.
No.
It would pay for itself pretty quickly.
Are you disappointed at the way this country has progressed with its energy program?
Yes, I am. And a lot of it is because we have many obvious solutions in front of us. And it seems as if there's obstruction in many cases. But we can't let that get us down. You know, we know that we have solutions, and we know that they're emerging. And I try to put a positive spin on things anytime I look at it, because it does us no good to be upset about the bad side of things. There's enough trouble every day. We have to look to finding solutions for things. That's what I concentrate on. Let's find a solution. So regardless of how badly the country has handled its energy policy and, you know, our backup systems, we really don't have any. But we have, as individuals, the ability to do just about anything we want. The real stumbling block right now is cost. But those are coming down. They are coming down, and it's available to everybody.
Why is everything so controversial, Charles? I mean, those who are proponents of the use of coal still, I mean, they are vehement. They want coal used. I guess it's for jobs.
Well, their jobs depend on it, you know, and we know how to use it. And it's definitely available here. And many people would do anything to get us off Middle Eastern oil or foreign oil of any sort, which, you know, is a laudable goal. It's something we should do. We shouldn't be burning oil. Petroleum is too valuable to be burning. It should be used as a source for plastics and industrial chemicals and lubricants and things such as that, of that nature. We don't need to burn up that resource. We don't need to put more carbon dioxide in our air. And the fact is, when you go to people who have an interest in a specific source of energy such as coal, they really need to sell coal, and that's what they want to do. It's not necessarily an obstruction from their standpoint. They're looking at a means of developing a source of energy they have. The issue is they clearly stand to profit from it. Now, and understand, I don't have a problem with people making a profit, but I think that there's a better course.
Well, we will find out soon enough, won't we? Because I don't think we could stay on this path, can we?
No, we certainly can't. It's definitely not sustainable. We have enough energy around us. We'll never run out. We've got more than everything we'll ever need. You know that. One of my favorite quotes
I agree
came up with. We have everything we need to make everything we'll ever need.
For a long, long time.
That's right.
Let's take some phone calls next hour. You ready for some of that?
Certainly. Absolutely.
Sir Charles Schulz is our special guest. We'll take phone calls with him next hour. And then in the final hour, we're going to talk about preparedness with Mr. Matthew Stein on Coast to Coast AM. So we'll be right back to take your calls. Fascinating discussion with Sir Charles Schulz, and we'll take your phone calls with him. And we'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. All right, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and to the phones we go with our friend Sir Charles Schulz. By the way, Charles, do you travel at all?
Yes, I do. I just got back from Yucatan about a month ago, and I'm hoping to do some more travel while I'm consulting on energy projects in this country as well.
Good for you. Let's take some calls here. First of all, we'll pick up George in Manhattan, east of the Rockies. Hey, George, good morning.
Good morning, George. And Sir Charles, you
yes.
are an inspiration.
Thank you.
And I think everything you're saying is right. I've got, you know, a bunch of degrees, and I was always wondering why everything gets stopped. And I think there's a group of international financiers that just want to protect their turf, their territory. You talked about being sued. I mean, little companies trying to do this, trying to do that. And you're absolutely right, absolutely right. I believe in God, and we have most wonderful world on this planet, and we are the most wonderful beings that He ever created, and we've got the answers, except that there are a bunch of greedy guys that are trying to stop everything.
Well, it certainly seems that way sometimes, but you know, we have to focus on the positive. We have to do what needs to be done. And we can't allow people to stand in the way. Each and every one of us knows how to make the world better, and it's our responsibility to do that.
All right, let's go to David in Winnipeg, Canada. Hey, David, go ahead.
Wow, this is the greatest day of my life. You're God, George. To your guest, quick questions, and I'll get off the air. It's not cold up here either. X-37B, I'd like you to discuss that, how that just launched the day after the President of the United States said they're not going to the moon. I'd like you to discuss that. And as well as nobody talks about the amount of nuclear weapons that have been actually used on the planet and what that effect of all of those things buried into the ground, like in the Nevada desert or in an ocean off of some coast that the French Antilles. No one really discusses the amount of nuclear weapons that have actually been detonated. There's no actual physical number for it. No one really knows. North Korea, I'd like to discuss those two things. And again, a pleasure, George. Your show is the best. I've listened to you guys for over 12 years. I will not stop. I even got a CC radio to record it.
All right. Thanks, David. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Well, the X-37, as far as that goes, many projects are already ready to fly, and they just have to wait for the right slot or the right conditions. So the measures, you know, that the president mentioned on television don't necessarily have an influence on it. I think it's just very interesting that when they did the flight, they really were unable to carry out the mission as they expected. They in fact, two things were launched at the same time. The X-37B was launched, and they had a failure with that vehicle. And then Orbital Sciences built a vehicle that was called the launcher for the hypersonic test vehicle, and that lost communication 9 minutes into the flight. It was supposed to fly at Mach 20. To give you an example, Mach 25 is about orbital speed. So these things, you know, both of these vehicles were advanced vehicles, and both of them failed, and they were launched within a day of each other. So that's very, very interesting. But one of the things it says is we still have a lot to learn. The issue of nuclear explosions is a very interesting one. The research I've done has turned up at least 2,500 nuclear explosions that have been set off on this planet. And many of them were deep underground in situations where the radioactivity would not escape. And a lot of it was done for research and even for engineering. There's some serious consideration of using clean warheads to dig canals and infrastructure in parts of the world. But, of course, that was originally the move of the Atoms for Peace group. That seems to have vanished, and there's very little discussion about it now. But I do expect we're going to hear more about that within the next 5 years.
What would be your favorite alternative energy source and use of?
Orbital solar, definitely. And I've been working with Space Island Group for a number of years to get that to happen. They're doing the real push as far as the legwork, negotiating, and technology. And I'll be supplying some of the technology they use when we get the satellite flying.
All right, Michael, first-time caller in Dallas. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I listen to your show all the time, and I noticed on this particular show you skipped over, or you briefly mentioned the hemp issue. About 10 years ago, I was recruited to direct a film. We've called it Hempsters Plant the Seed. Our website's Hempsters. Hempsterthemovie.com if you want to check out the details. But I first got into this and didn't think it was really as profound as the hemp activists said it was. But if you really check into it, what's amazing is that this plant could be the solution. It grows more biomass per acre than any plant. It produces ethanol with the herd and biodiesel with the seed. So I talked to some seed manufacturers. They actually have different types of seed hybrids that can grow in any longitude or latitude on the earth, including, you know, except for the Arctic, but, you know, even desert areas. So I think that if the subject of hemp was more studied and found out why it's been made illegal in America, it could open the door to a real solution to fuel instead of an alternative. It's actually a solution.
And I think one of the reasons it was illegal a long time ago was because as it was used for paper, Hearst wanted his all his forests used for paper, and I think he was able to get that illegalized,
exactly.
Sort of, right?
Yeah. The most amazing thing is that, like, the American groups that want to talk about it talk about a test crop at universities, but 27 nations around the world grow hemp now. Canadians are into their, like, 10th or 11th year of commercial production of industrial hemp.
Can they get the price down, Michael?
Pardon?
Can they get the price down if they're going to make it, let's say, per gallon?
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, if you when our film comes out this June, you can see we interviewed some doctors and PhDs that tell the exact BTUs and how it can be done. It's just a matter of growing more. But the key is, and the interesting thing is that the Drug Enforcement Agency gets $1.05 per plant when they turn in this so-called marijuana. But 99% of what they're bringing in is actually feral ditch weed, and only 1% is actually marijuana. So in an acre, a Canadian farmer gets like $450, but the DEA is getting thousands of dollars per acre because In an acre, thousands of plants grow, and they get $1.05 per plant. So the Native Americans are trying to make their headway with exercising their sovereignty. And we worked with Alex Whiteplume out there at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and we actually filmed the DEA coming in and chopping these plants down. They say it's called the Federal Eradication Program, but they're chopping it down with weed eaters. They're not eradicating anything. The seeds hit the ground and come back the next year. The key is how much money they're getting, $1.05 per plant. And like I said, in an acre, there's thousands of plants, and then they burn it. We're going to try to propose that maybe they give the feral ditchweed back to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and let them use it to convert to ethanol.
All right, let's get your reaction to that, Sir Charles. And as we talked about, at this point, it's expensive to produce and to turn into fuel. If it comes down in price, Michael's right, it's a pretty good source. But can it?
Well, it could. It could. One of the things about the hemp plant is it's very, very hardy. And it, as you said, it grows very rapidly. It produces a huge amount of biomass. What's important is that almost any biomass can be converted into ethanol, including such things as switchgrass. So if you wanted to go the ethanol route, you can do it. The issues involved with producing ethanol in that manner is that you have to basically put the plant material in a form that can be fermented. It becomes a water-intensive process, but with enough biomass and a dedicated factory, you certainly could produce enough fuel to make it economically feasible. Absolutely.
All right. We go to Dan in Hemet, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Charlie. I've got a question.
Sure thing.
A few years ago, I ran into a Rolls-Royce mechanic that claimed to have invented a true perpetual motion electric motor that charged the battery that was running it while it was running. The question is perpetual motion, true perpetual motion, which is absolutely free energy, possible? And if so, how far are we away from it, really? And I'll hang up now.
Okay. Now, perpetual motion as a term is generally considered to be impossible because if you can draw energy out of a system, the energy has to be replaced from somewhere. If you had a machine that ran forever and you took energy out of it, it would slow down. So let's bring it into two classes, energy-generating machines and perpetual motion machines. You might argue that an atom is a perpetual motion machine because its electrons are always moving and it doesn't wear down, it doesn't break.
Good point.
But it's not something you can draw power out of without taking the atom apart. As from what we've seen, every test in physics and thermodynamics has shown that the energy to run a system or to create power with has to come from somewhere. You don't get it for free. So it would be very surprising to me and many other people if you found a system that just generated power out of nothing. There would have to be a source somewhere for that power.
Are you familiar with the Searle effect by any chance?
I've seen some videos. I was looking into that, and I couldn't see exactly what it is that they're supposed to be doing. I don't really know enough about it. I wasn't able to get enough definitive information about it. The story is interesting. You know, he made a machine that seemed to run and generate a lot of power. The machine was confiscated. He hasn't built another one. You know, it sounds like a common story. And I'm not going to say yes or no because, again, I don't have enough information. And I'm, you know, honest enough to admit if I don't have an answer, I'm not going to try and blow any smoke. I don't know what the Searle effect is about. I know there's a claim that it seems to generate a lot of power.
Yeah. I mean, he was on the program a few weeks ago, talked about how it works, the magnetics of it all. And a fascinating question. He would make little flying saucers in one big one. I asked him, I said, what happened to it? He said, well, it went through the roof. It kept going. And I said, where is it now? He said, I don't know. It's somewhere right way out in outer space. It just kept going.
Well, then all you'd have to do is tie it on a rope and tie that to a generator.
Yeah, absolutely. Nashville, Tennessee. Hello, Ed. It's your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
George, you stole my thunder. That was the question I was going to ask.
Well, come up with another one. You waited so long.
Lord have mercy. Well, I don't know much about energy, but a real quick question, if you don't mind, a little off the topic. How's our guy doing with the – is he getting his operation soon?
My friend who fell?
No, the gentleman that
– Oh, the cataracts. For the cataracts? Yeah, well, I'll have a new update for you next week. He's already had one put in. And, of course, they don't want to do two eyes at the same time. and he's got another one soon. But, yeah, all is well.
Yeah, great. Okay. Well, like I said, you kind of stole my thunder, but if that gentleman will take a look at his DVD, I think you'll probably get some more information on that, on the John Searle effect.
Absolutely.
But, all right. Well, thanks, George. You're the greatest.
Thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, Olympia, Washington. Hello, Greg. It's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi. You effectively altered my question about John Searle. It sounds like there's a little smoke there, but John Searle's device was confiscated. Very interesting. I was going to talk about the morass of controversy, comment, and confusion that that bedevils human management. And I was going to say, don't let John Searle sink into this morass. But we won't.
Because let me tell you, Greg, go ahead.
Okay, that was question number one. Question number two was, could you tell me about the National Ignition Center in Livermore, California? That sank into the morass of information. I've heard about it once, never heard about it again.
Well, I can't answer that. Maybe you can, Charles. But again, with John Searle, we're going to keep having him on as a guest. We're not going to lose touch with him. Go ahead.
Okay, well, in Lawrence Livermore in California, they're firing up the National Ignition Facility. And in essence, what that is a means of using a battery of lasers focused on a tiny point containing fuel and igniting it just like a sun. I had a very close associate who worked with Lawrence Livermore on the Shiva laser project years and years ago, and they had 24 beams. Basically, they've been doing a lot of upgrades to the technology, and the hope is they can drop pellets in this thing rapidly and fire each one to create a miniature sun and, in essence, make fusion energy that runs like a putt-putt over and over. So I don't know just how many advances they've made lately. I know they were doing some major tests just recently. That's one of the things I really want to watch because it's a very promising way of generating power. The issue that I take with it is it's a huge, huge facility, and it takes an immense amount of energy to do it. They want to show what's known as break-even, the ability to create more power from each burst than they actually put into the lasers to operate it.
All right, Livermore, California, close by. John, go ahead. Hi, John.
Yeah, boy, that was a great lead-in tonight.
Sure was. What a flow, huh?
Yeah, boy, you've got it down there. Yeah, I won't say what I do, but I work at the place you talked about. And the question I had for Sir Charles was, what was his, if he gives me his crystal ball, what does he think the future is for fusion energy? It's the Holy Grail. It's been worked on for 50 years. We haven't seen anything yet, but
absolutely.
I want to get his sort of crystal ball view.
Okay, John.
Okay. Recently they did some work known as sand pile physics, and they found that there was something interesting in how you pile sand before it topples that has the same mathematical characteristics as a fusion reaction. And so some progress was made analyzing actually falling sand piles. And that seems like an out and left field thing, but the mathematics they found supported the research in fusion. My personal feeling, based on the experiments I've done, is that fusion power is really at a crippling point because we're using huge magnetic fields or huge lasers. It makes it next to impossible to build a facility without it being larger than a power plant and consuming a huge amount of energy just to operate. Fusion power will most likely, in my opinion, and I'm going to make that very clear, come from electrostatic confinement. There was a fellow by the name of Philo Farnsworth, the fellow who invented the television, and he built a fusion device that used electrostatics. Now, he didn't own or control the patents or rights to it. He was able to do some research and develop what's known as the Farnsworth-Hirsch fuser, and this device was quickly snapped up by the military to use as a neutron source. So this thing is about the size of a softball, a little bit bigger, and it generates neutrons. And that means they are indeed getting true nuclear fusion. The issue with the Farnsworth-Hirsch fuser is that it doesn't produce as much energy as it consumes. But with the technology we have now, even college students are building them. I see that with minor modifications, it could prove to be the energy machine of the future.
Really? You're that bullish on it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The thing could be small enough to set on a tabletop, and if done properly, you could probably generate an energy source that runs on tabletop tap water, hydrogen, and generates enough power to run your home.
Isn't that amazing? Truly amazing, Charles. Will we ever get there, honestly?
I think we will, and part of it is going to depend on new materials. Right now, superconductors figure big in fusion research facilities, but the magnets are huge. We're getting close to what's known as room temperature superconduction. That would mean you could make incredibly powerful magnets that run without the use of cryogenics such as liquid nitrogen. That would be a huge tool, a leverage to allow to make smaller fusion research reactors. But as far as tabletop fusion, you know, I did a lot of research in cold fusion. We certainly got what we felt was the actual, you know, the real deal. We got the triggering mechanism, and it basically didn't go anywhere. Recent research shows that the Department of the Navy and the Department of Defense are both researching it for use in weapons systems.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back and take final phone calls with Sir Charles Schultz before next hour we talk about emergency preparedness. On our next Coast to Coast program, a huge show on medicine and alternative health. I mean huge. And then on the Thursday program, we'll be talking with a couple special experts about what was behind the movie The Exorcist and other hauntings as well. And then Friday, a couple of interviews with James Fox and the latest on some UFO cases with open lines as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back with Final Calls with Charles Schultz. Charles, you want to give out some email addresses or websites?
Yes, I have a new website. Everybody, of course, is familiar with the Xenotech Research website that I've had for many years, and that's xenotechresearch.com. I've opened a new one called Schultz Laboratories, and in that site we have a virtual science center we're establishing so people can actually interact with exhibits as if they were in a real science center. And so that website is on your site and easy for them to get to. If I spell it out, they're going to get something wrong.
Okay, you got it. Let's go back to the calls. Halifax, Pennsylvania. Go ahead, Wayne. Thanks for calling. Wayne, you there? Hello, Wayne.
We seem to have lost him.
Yes, we did. He disappeared into the ozone. Morro Beach, California. We have Russ, though. Go ahead, Russ.
Hi, George. Hi, Sir Charles. Yeah, I'm in Morro Bay, California. It's, you know where San Luis Obispo is?
Yep.
I was just a question about the water you were talking about. How do we know if you're buying real spring water or distilled water? And you always hear these claims about all the water may be tap water anyway.
Yeah, that's a good question. Do you really know?
Actually, you can't tell in many cases. And if you analyze it, the materials dissolved in the water generally match tap water. So there was a big scandal a number of years ago about bottled water companies simply putting filtered tap water in the bottles. And now many of them say filtered tap water. In the case of distilled water, that's pretty easy to tell. There are many systems you can use to check what's dissolved in the water. And if the particulates and other material in it are below a certain level, then you know that it's been distilled.
All right, we go to Indianapolis. Timothy, you're up with us. Go ahead, Tim.
Oh, it's amazing that I got on. I got a couple of quick comments. One, basically, George, I wish you would play more Motown-inspired music. It's all on that. Other than that, I wanted to say that, you know, one of the greatest resources that we're kind of squandering away is human resource. And if you look around the world, how many people don't have a chance to participate? And you know, we don't know where the next cure for cancer or the next, you know, innovation and, you know, energy is going to come from. And to think that with all these minds out there that even in America, city by city, you go around and the way some of our schools are failing. And so I just think that that's something that needs to be looked into if we put more effort into getting more minds working on solving some of these issues, that we'd have a better chance to solve some of the problems that we're facing. Also, I want to make a comment about, you know, it's interesting that tobacco and liquor, what we produce, are legal, whereas poppies or cocoa or hemp are illegal. And, you know, if you look where the places where they come, you know, poppies were flowers long before they were drugs. And the whole trade in poppies has been going along a lot longer than we've been around. So I'm not saying that we should those things should be legalized, but there's this kind of hypocrisy when it comes to this higher ground we kind of take on the drug war and, you know, kind of keeping tabs on that. We suppress other people who in these economies that could be helped. You know,
well,
it's about money these days.
I'm even more radical, Tim. I think we should legalize this and control it that way. All this money
well,
that's going
and make
away.
Money.
Well, and what does a tax stamp do?
Yep.
You know, the government could turn a lot of things around if they legalized certain products. And hemp for fabrics and oil and that sort of product base would be a very simple way for them to raise a lot of money and help turn the economy around.
All right, let's go to Clearwater, Florida. Greg, it's your turn. Go ahead, Greg.
Yes, George Hitt. Thanks for taking my call and,
sure.
and another great show. I don't know how you do it. Anyway, Sir Charles, John Searle's stuff, is there any connection between that and what little Ed did down in Coral Castle? Because he was generating his own electricity and he was moving those 30 and 40 ton blocks of limestone, and no one knows how he did it. And I just think that why isn't everybody down there just checking it out to find out how this little guy did that? I mean, that's amazing.
Well, it is. You know, he was a master of mechanics and leverage, and I've been to the Coral Castle a couple of times myself. I love the yeah. area down there, and I lived in Central Florida for years. I don't know anything about the Searle effect to say whether it's related to what Ed Leedskalman, the fellow that built the Coral Castle, has done. I do know that he has used some very simple and clever mechanical devices in many cases. I don't think he did anything so unusual we wouldn't recognize it right away. He was very secretive about his methods.
Yes, right.
But more than anything, I think he was a heck of a good engineer. He knew exactly what he was doing. I use the phrase often enough when I'm telling people how to move heavy things, think like an Egyptian.
Yeah, well, he yeah. did. He said he knew the secrets of the pyramids, Charles.
Oh, yeah, there are some right. very simple things right. that you can do to move giant blocks around on the sand, very easy ones. Perhaps it would be worth me putting a page up for that.
Well, and he also wrote, Greg, thank you, he also wrote a book on magnetics. He believed everything was magnetic, everything.
Well, he did. You know, when you study the early universe, you find that all four forces were united at extremes of temperature and pressure. In the universe today, that's not so. Gravity, magnetism are completely different forces and don't influence each other to any degree. For to find a key between the electromagnetic field and the gravity field would be one of the holy grails.
Let's go to Jerry. Truck driving in Iowa, you're up with us. Hey, Jerry, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I had a quick question on electric vehicles. Why they can't come up with some kind of a generator that can recharge the vehicles as they're driving, somewhat like our vehicles do, our gasoline, diesel engines do with our car batteries. Has anybody ever experimented with that, or has that been tried? Or
yes,
what?
And the answer to that is actually very simple. If you are running an electric vehicle and it's moving down the road and you draw some of that energy off to run a charger, you're actually braking the vehicle. That's how you run your brakes. Your hubs in electric vehicles are motors, and when you put the brakes on, they go into regeneration mode. You see, to generate power back that way takes more power than you put in. In a diesel or gasoline-powered engine, the fuel is powering the charging of the battery and running the vehicle. You've got plenty of excess. But the problem is they consume a lot of power and they burn fuels. With an electric vehicle, you don't have the advantage of a tank of gas.
None at all. That's interesting, the way that would be able to work. But you know what? A couple of the big auto companies are coming out with some electric cars. I wonder how they'll sell.
We'll see.
We shall see. Houston, Texas, Jake, you're up with us, first-time caller. Go ahead, Jake.
How's it going, guys?
Good, Jake. Thanks.
Great.
I just wanted to ask y'all what y'all thought about the if they legalized marijuana, you know, they could get the hemp from the marijuana plant and also all the money the government stands to make from actually legalizing the marijuana, if they would actually taxate it and regulate it like they do alcohol.
Absolutely.
Well, they could, but again, we don't want to confuse the two issues. Marijuana is a completely different issue from industrial hemp, and industrial hemp doesn't have any drug ability.
But can't they use the hemp from the actual marijuana plant?
They could, but you know, you're going to have a real uphill battle if you're going to be fighting the drug battle as well as the materials battle.
No, I agree.
It's
far
simpler to use the hemp, the industrial hemp, as a source of fiber and materials that you need and not have to fight the drug enforcement laws.
Absolutely. Let's go to Dave in Spokane, Washington. Hey, David, go ahead.
Yes, Sir Charles, I wanted to mention about a fuel source that's totally clean, that produces tremendous amounts of energy, and we wouldn't need any nuclear power. It's being used right now in Iceland and New Zealand, and it's also being used to power the entire city of San Francisco, and yet none of the politicians, nobody seems to want to talk about it.
Well, it sounds like you're talking about geothermal.
Absolutely.
Well, I was living in New Mexico for quite a while, and in one of the places, they had so much hot water right under the city, all heated by the magma inside the earth, and there they had hot springs everywhere because of it. And it's a wonderful source of power, but its distribution is the problem. There are a lot of places where drilling deep enough to tap into geothermal would be prohibitively expensive.
I would say not nearly as expensive as building a nuclear power plant.
Well, the big expense in a power plant is because of the regulations and licensing. The last time I checked, it only took 8 licenses to build a standard power plant, but 64 to build a nuclear plant. And again, they got down to the issue of waste and its cost. But, you know, if we were to recycle the waste, we could reduce the waste volume by 97%.
Well, why is it that these two little countries can do it, geothermal, and yet we've got bubbling springs in Idaho, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, California, and yet we can't, nobody seems to want to talk about this energy source. They just want to say, they just kind of, they run away from it or something.
Well, there is some research in it, but in Iceland, the population density is far smaller, far lower than many of the areas in this country. It's very suitable in Iceland because it's very near the surface. They don't have that large a population base to supply, and it's easily accessible for them. In many cases in this country, that wouldn't necessarily be the case. And again, you know, people are working to try and get off the grid and create their own. While geothermal is a wonderful idea, it leaves you on the grid as well. The real move would be to decentralize power, make everybody independent if possible. But
nice.
I agree, geothermal has a great future ahead of us. We'd never run out of it.
Is it cheap?
It depends. Most of the installations they've done have been near volcanically active areas. Remember the big volcano just a couple of weeks ago on the airline flights. Well, that's one of the symptoms of geothermal energy. In areas around here, it would be very expensive because you're generally not near a volcanically active area, as well you didn't want to be.
How about this solution, Charles? Rubber band power. Run our vehicles on big rubber bands.
The most effective energy storage system ever devised is the rubber band, and many people don't know that. Many years ago, they had a little wind-up airplane with a propeller and a rubber band on it.
I love those things.
Yes, they were wonderful. They worked so well because they used rubber bands, a very, very effective energy storage system. So, yes, the rubber band is the most effective energy storage system we have, believe it or not.
John is in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hey, John, go ahead.
Hello, Sir Charles and George.
Hello.
I woke up today with an idea on corking that leaking pipe in the Gulf of Mexico. I know they're talking about filling it full of debris with their little robots and things, but why couldn't they use an inflatable bladder or balloon, have their little robots stick that in there and run a hydraulic line up to that ship and inflate a balloon to cork that like doctors use for
like an angiogram. Yeah.
Yes, just like an angiogram process.
I'll take the answer offline.
Is an excellent solution, and I'm sure that some of them are thinking about it. I don't know if that's what they're going to do. The issue is that when you insert something in the line, oil is gushing out of it. You have to be able to clear the pipe out of the way.
Yes.
You have to be able to clear the valve out of the way. Unless they could get it into the pipe below the break, then it would be very, very difficult. The ability to insert a balloon in there would mean you'd have to cut off below the first break in the pipe, get the balloon in against the flow of liquid, and then inflate it. I'm sure it could be done, but the engineering challenges would be very formidable at this point.
Charles, what if they just blew it up and hopefully everything caved in?
Well, first of all, explosives that deep, you've got a mile of water pressure on top of you. That would be a real problem. Many things won't explode that deep. The other is, it's already spewing oil. If you blow it up, you'll have a hole that's very dirty, a lot of cracked edges, a lot of debris. It might be impossible to seal at that point.
Okay, good point. Good point. All right. Lowell in Shelton, Connecticut. Hey, Lowell, thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to comment on the electric cars. One source of energy that seems to be there continuously, the wind that's going against the car. Why couldn't they funnel the wind through funnels built into the car and generate electricity that way?
Well, because the drag acts, again, as a brake, just like a parachute would. If you're funneling wind from the vehicle into a generator, you're slowing the vehicle down. Again, every time you convert energy from one form to another, there's a loss of efficiency. In a vehicle, you really want to have the slipperiest surface so it has the least resistance to the wind. If you capture the wind, you're slowing your vehicle down.
And isn't the drag there anyway, though?
Well, there is some drag, but if you put more drag in, and it becomes greater, the vehicle loses its speed much more rapidly.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. We've got Dino in L.A. Hey, Dino, go ahead.
Yes. Where could I be referred to get an understanding of the water purification technique that you had mentioned? You said something about ozone purification.
Yes.
All right. Good question.
Ozone is a very reactive chemical. As some people know, oxygen we breathe has two oxygen atoms in it. Ozone has three oxygen atoms fit together. And so it's extremely reactive, and it will attack and destroy many different chemicals, plastics, organic material, living cells, and it's similar to hydrogen peroxide in that respect. Ozone is also used as a bleaching agent, but it has a very short life and it breaks down rapidly. If you look online, ozone is used in many places for purifying drinking water, for cleaning swimming pool water, and other processes very similarly. So ozone is generally energy inefficient to generate. It takes a lot of power to make ozone. You can find out a great deal online about it, I'm sure, by looking in Google under ozone and water treatment. What is different in what I'm doing is I found an extremely efficient way of creating ozone, and that's one of the technologies I'd like to share with people.
All right, very good. Good luck, Dino. Let's see, time for maybe one more quick question, maybe two. Michael in Albany. Go ahead, Mike. Let's see if we can squeeze you in here.
Yes. I happen to overhear something in regards how someone upstairs is continually causing a problem when we have so many suggestions. Even with cancer, when you can say have turmeric, salad, and asparagus, and they'll knock out the cancer pretty much. So one of the other things maybe would be to perhaps we should take them out of government and perhaps again we might be able to get something done.
Well, I don't know about that, Michael. I don't know about that at all. Myra, let's go to you in Atlanta. Go ahead.
Hello, how you doing?
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for having me. I just wanted to make a comment. I hate that nobody really gets into the electromagnetic thing. I've read up on Nikola Tesla, and a few months back you had a guy who had invented one somewhere in Indiana. He had tried to get the three major car dealers to buy or manufacture his electromagnetic car. No one did. But also, I wanted to say Google corporate office has a new cell energy. They're completely off the grid. I don't know who this guy is. I seen him on TV about a month or so ago. And they are running their entire corporate office off this small grid. And he made a small cubicle device that each house could have. They were about $3,000, but I don't know the guy's name. I can't remember. How about
all right.
It seems to me it was the Bloom Energy thing, and I think that's what it was.
Yes, it was. Bloom, right?
Yes, yes.
Very good. Charles, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you, George. It's always a pleasure. I appreciate
it. You too, my friend. Sir Charles Schultz III.